Palestinians continue to flee south in search of safety that just isn't there. Hospitals are buckling under extreme pressure as casualties mount. The UN has described a level of fear and panic not seen before, as Gazans experience one of the worst 24 hours since the beginning of the war nearly 2 months ago. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in overnight Israeli strikes, bringing the death toll since Saturday to more than 800. Hamas says fierce fighting has been taking place near the southern city of Khan Yunis, where Israel claims Hamas fighters are based. Meanwhile, Hamas has denounced the UK for planning to conduct surveillance flights over the Gaza Strip, calling it a partner in Israel's war. More than 15,500 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli shelling, more than 6,600 of them children, since October 7th. The death toll from the Hamas surprise attack on Israel remains at 1,200. So what's the Israeli regime's end game in the Gaza Strip? What impact is its genocidal campaign having on the civilian population? How many Palestinian lives does it take for a change in policy on Israel in Western capitals? Joining me for this conversation, London-based mindset life coach and mentor Neil Nasser, and from Birmingham, social justice educator and activist Hassanein Jaffer, joining us via Skype. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Starting with you, Neil, with the bombardment of Gaza having resumed well and truly, was this always the worry that things were going to move in this direction?
I think, you know, taking that pause in terms of the war and that mild ceasefire, then the militia then ramp it up. And the worry is that it's going to intensify and increase the attacks, which, as we can see happening right now, it has increased the numbers as we're reporting. It's been the worst 24 hours since the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. So that's always been the worry in terms of the plan, if you like, the ultimate plan.
Speaking of the plan, Hassanein, Israel's Hayom newspaper has carried a story in the past 24 hours or so that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel has asked his closest political confidant, Ron Dermer, to devise a plan that would thin out, quote-unquote, the population of Gaza to a bare minimum. Is that what we're seeing unfold, as we have feared and warned all along?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's barely an argument anymore to say that this isn't a colonial exploit. And from the very beginning, I mean, even if you go all the way back in history, from 1948, the Zionist plan has always been to displace the people of Palestine and to create a homeland that doesn't include the Palestinians. It has always been a colonial exploit, which is why, you know, unless you have a memory that doesn't last longer than the 7th of October, none of this comes as a surprise to us that their ultimate aim is to get the land that the Palestinians are occupying without any Palestinians on that land. There's no other word for it other than ethnic cleansing. It's genocide.
Ethnic cleansing and genocide. Some would even say ethnic cleansing is some kind of a euphemism for genocide, to avoid the use of the word genocide. The role of the Americans, like, mm-hmm. It is believed that the U.S. administration is the only government that Israel might listen to. Do you think, I mean, what is the kind of relationship between the two, and is the Israeli war cabinet even listening to the American administration, or are they doing everything green-lighted by the Americans in the first place?
I think there's that green light there. I think, are they listening to outside influences? Probably not. They have their own agenda, but they have supporters from particular Western countries that are pushing them in this direction. The ultimate goal is to take that land. As we know, there is resources under that land that they're trying to occupy, they're trying to take. They're trying to take control of the Suez Canal so they can occupy that space as well. You know, the agenda goes beyond the political agenda. This is an agenda to wipe out the Palestinians. As we said, this ethnic cleansing, this genocide that's going on, is to basically take those resources so the wealthier can get wealthier.
What do you think of the same thing, Hassanein? Who does the solution really lie with? The Americans have drawn the redisplacement of Palestinians. we're seeing it happen as we speak, as a red line, at least publicly. We know the Egyptians' position, for example, in opening the Rafah border crossing. What's going on there? Are they, again, not listening to anybody, continuing with their campaign against the Palestinians, ultimately, as you say, to drive them out into the desert, the Sinai?
I mean, we only have to look at the history of the Western powers and what they have done over the last 200-300 years to recognize that what's happening now works within the system. It works in their favor. The British and Americans run in an imperial manner. So they will support anything that meets their ends, which is the growth of capital, essentially, to be able to have a base in the Middle East and to be able to perpetuate their white supremacist agenda. This has always been the way. I think what Kamala Harris said recently about, you know, there's too much civilian loss of life, and even all the rhetoric we see that says, oh, we need to control civilian casualty numbers, all of this is just that. It's just rhetoric, because ultimately, the only reason that America and Britain and all these imperial powers will ever step in and call for a ceasefire is when it matches their agenda. And it will match their agenda when we make it match their agenda, when we make it too expensive, too inconvenient, when the international pressure is enough for them to stop what they're doing. But I mean, we never have been able to rely on Britain, America, any of these imperial powers to do what's in the best interest of people, and we shouldn't be waiting for them right now.
And that is despite the overwhelming majority, like in the U.S., more than 60% of the people who have been polled mm-hmm. have asked for a permanent ceasefire. In the U.K., 2/3 of the people polled have asked for a ceasefire. Still, all of that and all the mass protests that mm-hmm. we have seen in weeks have fallen on deaf ears in the corridors of power here at Downing Street, as well as in Washington.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think, as Hassanein just said, it doesn't align with their agenda. You know, the voice of the voiceless is not being heard right now. We are that voice of that voiceless when we're out on the streets and we're marching and we're raising our voices for this ceasefire to take place. It doesn't align with the political agenda. The political agenda for control. Ultimately, they want to have that base in the Middle East mm-hmm. so they can control that particular region. They want the resources that are under that land. They want control of the Suez Canal. They want to eradicate the Palestinians. So, yes, millions of people are marching and protesting, over 60% in that poll in the USA. But what impact is happening?
And we keep going back to that quote by the now U.S. president when he was a congressman, Senator Joe Biden, who said if there hadn't been an Israel, yes. the U.S. would have to create one.
Exactly.
As if they didn't help create it in the first place. All right, we're going to pause for now to bring in some Iranian government perspective into this. Iran's foreign minister says a deep expansion of war across the region is imaginable as the bombardment of Gaza resumed after a temporary truce. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking from Tehran during a joint briefing with Omani foreign minister Syed Badr Abul Saidi.
Yesterday we heard from resistance leaders that if the current situation continues, the region will enter a new phase through resistance. Deep expansion of war in the region is absolutely imaginable. All parties who are after igniting a war are warned. Before it's too late, stop the killing of women and children, of which a new round has started. We hope that our brothers in Egypt will urgently reopen the Rafah border and stop the Israeli plot against the territorial integrity of Egypt and Jordan.
We heard Neil Nasser, Mr. Amir Abdullahian there, calling for the killing of the children and women to stop. I want you to put your life coach hat on and talk about the sort of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that the children and the women, the population of Gaza, will be suffering. Those who are lucky enough to stay alive.
Yes, exactly.
In the days, weeks, months, and years ahead of them.
That mass trauma that they're witnessing right now, seeing their loved ones, their family members, their friends being brutally murdered and in this assassination of life will hold and resonate within them for years to come. This is a memory that they will never get rid of. It's an issue in terms of their mental health and their mental well-being as they grow and go through their lives. Something that trauma will have an impact and a stamp on their lives. Mm-hmm. There is ways to deal with that through professional support and through medical support and attention through professional services, but they don't have access to the basic things like food and water.
Much less that kind of counseling.
Exactly.
To help them get over or probably deal with their trauma.
Yes.
Hassanein, there must surely be an understanding that Gazans can't just be patched up to be bombed again, to be told to move from one area to another and only to be told to move yet again to someplace else.
I mean, it betrays the hypocrisy of the Israelis, right? Like, initially they came in and they were talking about Hamas, and then where is Hamas? So they asked people to move from the north to the south. They keep moving the line. Essentially, now we're at a stage where the numbers for the Nakba in 1948 have been surpassed, both in terms of number of people displaced and number of people killed. Like, we are at a major turning point in history. I think what's really important to recognize here is that we have lived in the last few centuries through colonial exploits, right? We've seen what's happened. You know, we know that America lives on stolen land. We know that colonial exploits have occurred in Africa, in Asia, all over the world. But never have we been in a situation where it is happening right now and being live streamed to us, where we are seeing live the impact of this colonial exploit. Like, it is really a test for each and every one of us as to how we would respond, how we respond in these situations. But yeah, what Israel is doing is, you know, they are being so blatant in the atrocity, in the way they're carrying out these atrocities, that there is no room for rhetoric. There is no room for conjecture. Like, there is no space for them left to say that this is somehow about safety or self-defense or anything other than a major blatant land grab at the cost of millions of people displaced, thousands of people killed, including very young children. And the cost of it, you know, will, yes, there will be trauma, and there will be intergenerational trauma for years to come.
Like you say, there's no room for rhetoric. But what there is room for, Neil Nasser, and I will come back to you with the same question, Hassanein, as well, is you can fight back through other means, not necessarily violent means, mm-hmm. although colonialists and people who waged apartheid against people never left on their own volition, had to be forced out.
Yeah.
There is the economic way of doing it.
Yes.
Looking at, for example, at the share price of Starbucks during the past month, mm-hmm. BDS have helped bring down apartheid South Africa. Can something like that be or have the same kind of impact on the Israeli regime moving forward? Everybody,
yes,
teamed up.
That's it.
And did the same thing.
I think that's the conclusion. It needs to be a united front. So everybody needs to be boycotting the Israeli front. Everything that support the companies that are supporting the Israeli front, they need to be diminished from your shopping list. You need to restrict yourself from going to these places like Starbucks. We see that share price dropping. If we are united within this, then that voice can be heard in the way that they actually feel it. Yeah. Because our voices, physical voices, are not being heard, but these people feel it in their pockets more. So if we can hit them hard in that way and come together and boycott all of these companies, and there's many of them, then possibly there'd be a stronger way of moving forward.
From Starbucks to heavy machinery manufacturers.
Yes.
Hassanein, so BDS's strength in its ability to adapt, penetrate, and garner support, it has triggered Israel's greatest fear of a shift in global public opinion regarding its history and legitimacy. So moving forward, again, the same question. What kind of an impact can a movement like BDS have on Israel and its future?
Well, BDS is a really important part of the movement we need to have, but it goes wider than just BDS. We have to remember that this colonial exploit is about capital gain. Like, ultimately, colonialism as a concept came around because of capitalism. And capitalism relies on this hyper-individualism, keeping each of us isolated from each other. Because when we consume like that, we are worth more in terms of our economic value. But actually, what we need to do is come together, like the brother said, and have a united front. Part of that is boycott, but it goes even further than boycott. You know, boycott is a really, really important part of the movement. Protest is a really important part of the movement. You know, appealing to parliamentarians, writing to them, all of that is important. But coming together and recognizing that actually the only reason these systems are able to function, capitalism, white supremacy, the economy and the inequality in the economy, all of it is able to function because we participate in that. And I think we're at the stage where now we have to think about how do we withdraw our participation? How do we, in our very existence and the way we relate with the world, stop being normal and start thinking about being disruptive and start thinking about how do we make sure that this stops? For now, it's about ceasefire. Yes, we need a ceasefire to happen. And after that, it's about free Palestine. And after that, it's about liberating the world. But we need to think about boycott, yes, but even wider than boycott. We need to think about real disruption.
Exactly. And that should happen at the level of people, the individuals, and of course, at the level of leadership by countries cutting economic ties or selling fossil fuel or other energies to the Israeli regime or having economic ties, as called for by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Now, the ongoing plight of the Palestinian remains a global concern as participants at the United Nations COP28 climate talks filed in for more talks. They found themselves greeted by a rare sight in the United Arab Emirates, a protest. A handful of demonstrators held up a sign calling for a ceasefire in the war on Gaza, some reading a long list of Palestinian names and their ages who had been killed in the Gaza Strip. Criticism of Israel's conduct in the war has peppered much of the summit, from world leaders as well as activists.
Yes, it's a call for a ceasefire on Gaza, because the people who have died, the innocent children, the innocent mothers, the innocent sisters and brothers who have died in Gaza, it's enough. It's time for this war and this bombing to stop. Every opportunity we have, or every arena of the struggle, is one that we must embrace. And the COP is an arena for struggle. And it's a good place to put this kind of injustices going on around the world in the front burner. The war or the bombing in Gaza is not new to Gaza. It has happened in other climes, but sometimes we keep our ears, we close our eyes, and we walk away. But it's time for the world to take action. And this is a good opportunity for our world to take action, to call for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Now, in the UK, under Article 10 of the Human Rights Act of 1998, everyone has the right to freedom of expression in the country. However, that freedom is not guaranteed to those supporting Palestine. Earlier, we spoke to Fahima Mota, who was arrested as she left a recent pro-Palestinian procession here in London.
The protests had finished, and we were making our way back towards where our cars were parked. We saw two ladies getting arrested, and what I did was, as you said, something along the lines of, girls, stay strong, free Palestine. And a lady police officer came and she pushed me. And I said to her, you know, there was no reason for you to push me. I was just talking to them. And I had continued walking. And she said, oh, you need to keep it moving. So I said, can I have your badge number and your name? After that point, we were followed by the police up until we got to Piccadilly Circus. When we got to Piccadilly Circus, we were playing music, Palestine songs, and, you know, we were all just having some snacks because we hadn't eaten since breakfast, so we were really hungry. And we got, I'd say, like about 25, 30 police officers that came. And two of them went straight to my friend and two of them came straight over to me. And she said to me that there's Section 35 public dispersal order over here, so you need to leave immediately. So I said, I'm not from London, so I don't know my way around here. My friend who you're searching currently, as soon as you're finished with the search, we will leave. And she said, are you refusing to leave? And I said, no, I'm not refusing to leave. I'm just saying right now I can't leave, but I have full intention of leaving. And then she asked me for my name and address and my details. And I said to her, you know, have I committed a crime? Legally, I'm not required to give my details unless I've committed a crime. And that's when she said, are you refusing to give your details? I said, I'll give you my details if you tell me the reason that you need them. And that's when she basically said time of arrest and she put the handcuffs on. After that, I was arrested. We were taken to a police station. I was booked in.
Despite the treatment meted out to Fahima at the police station, where Islamophobia was apparent, she says she will not be silent.
We live in a country where they speak about freedom of speech, and we have the right to protest. So then why was I arrested? When I wasn't even protesting at that point, I just had my keffiyeh on and I had a Palestine flag. My parents came into the country to give us a better future and because of the British values, but really there's a lot of hypocrisy that we're seeing, that some people are allowed to raise their voice and speak openly about their views and beliefs, but the other side has completely been shut down. And, you know, we were... it came to light when the comments were made by the ex-Home Secretary, and the racism that we saw, Islamophobia is on the rise at the moment as well, and racism. And also, like, I wear a hijab, and when I was at the police station, they asked me to take my hijab off for my ID. And I said to them, I've worn this since I was a child. Over my dead body, you're going to ask me to take my hijab off. I will never take it off. And I just sat down on the floor and I said, you know, I've been so cooperative along this whole thing that you've done. You know, I didn't resist my arrest. But asking me to take my hijab off, I feel like that's you being Islamophobic and racist. And I won't take it off, even if you tell me that you're going to book me into a jail, basically. And she went and spoke to the senior and they agreed that they would let me to keep my hijab on. And I think that just... prove to me that if you stick to your beliefs and if you stay strong, then Palestine will be free, inshallah, one day.
All right, let's continue the conversation here with my guests in the studio as well as on Skype. Hassanein, has this whole thing made bridging the gap between certain groups harder than ever?
Yeah, I mean... unity is an interesting concept, right? Like, we can't take unity for granted in terms of we all want to be united no matter what. I think unity comes about as a result of us having our hearts together behind the same sort of cause. So when we look at what's happening in Israel and Palestine, we can see now how the Jewish community, for example, has been massively active all over the world in calling for a ceasefire. And these are our Jewish brothers and sisters who are standing up and saying, yeah, stop using Judaism as an excuse for your Zionist war crimes. This is the sort of unity that we want to promote, this unity behind a cause and not just unity for the sake of unity. So, yes, we want to get together with people all over the world. But it's difficult, right? Like we talked about earlier and the brother mentioned about Ukraine, when everything happened in Ukraine, obviously we want the best outcome for all humans all over the world. But it was a bit of a shock to us when we have seen Syrian refugees, Iraqi refugees, when we have seen the victims of all these other conflicts on that side of the world be treated completely differently in Western countries. And suddenly, when it happened in Ukraine, you know, households opened up their doors to welcome Ukrainian refugees. And we all wanted to unite behind that, but it's difficult when you think, well, how come we're all uniting behind this one cause and not another? But what Palestine and what Palestinians are helping us to do is to recognize this for what it is, which is that it is about white supremacy. It is actually because of the color of their skin. And when we can call it that, and when we can recognize that there is people are treated differently according to the color of their skin, then we can start unpacking why that might be. And it's not just because we humans are inherently flawed.
Yeah.
It's because these systems are in place to allow Israel states like the US and the UK to get away with what they're doing, using dehumanization of their victims to get away with what they're doing. So when we talk about
in one, if that's, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're fast running out of time. I want to squeeze in one last question to Neil, and that is the UK's unqualified support for Israel, Hamas denouncing the UK for planning to conduct surveillance flights over the Gaza Strip, calling it a partner in Israel's crimes of complicity.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, it shows the level that they will go to show that support towards Israel, to show support towards the cause. They're partners in one bed, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, whatever they can do to support this cause, to help their agenda to grow even further. And what's their agenda? To eliminate all the Palestinians in Gaza, to again take the resources, take the land, take away the Suez Canal and force everybody out of there. We're going to see an increase in the bombings. We're going to see an increase in the terror that's going on out there in the days to come. I'm sure it's not going to end, but we need to have that voice, and we can have that voice again, as I said, not just physically, but through our actions, and have that united front with everybody.
And remind the UK government that it has moral responsibility,
exactly,
because of the Balfour Declaration and all the rest of it, to intervene and try and stop it. But we're yet to see that happen.
Yes.
All right, and with those comments, we are going to wrap up this show. Many thanks again to my guests, Neil Nasser, here in the studio with me, and Hassanein Jaffer on Skype for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack. We'll be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your thoughts. Thank you.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A number of financial and economic institutions warned that Britain will slump into a moderate recession in the first half of 2024 as the struggle for growth remains while borrowing costs stay elevated. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Fears that the United Kingdom is heading for a recession this winter have intensified amid signs that Britain's hard-pressed households are cutting spending as they save for Christmas and higher fuel bills. Two monthly snapshots of retail activity found shops and online outlets struggling because of consumer budgets being squeezed by dearer mortgages and UK's lingering cost of living crisis. The British Retail Consortium, the BRC, the industry's lobby group, and Barclays Bank said sales were down in October once inflation was taken into account. The Bank of England has raised interest rates 14 times since December of 2021, but the downbeat reports from retailers suggest Threadneedle Street's actions to bring down inflation has come at the expense of weaker consumer confidence and lower sales volumes. Barclays says card spending rose by 2.6% in the year to October, significantly lower than the 6.7% inflation rate measured by the latest Consumer Prices Index. The Barclays KPMG monitor of retail activity said sales were up 2.5% on October 2022, but stressed its figures were not adjusted for inflation. News of the slowdown came as the latest health check on the UK construction sector from Standard & Poor's Global and the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply showed house building contracting for an 11th successive month. The Standard & Poor's Global and the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply report showed all three categories of construction, infrastructure, commercial property and house building below the 50 level that marks the cut-off point between the growing and declining sector. But of the three, house building was the weakest, registering a score of 38.5. Meanwhile, evidence that consumers are wary of committing to big-ticket items emerged from the latest car sales figures from the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. These showed a near 30% year-on-year jump in fleet sales, but only a 0.3% increase to 62,915 in sales to private buyers. Helen Dickinson, the British Retail Consortium's chief executive, said retail sales growth slowed as high mortgage and rental costs further shook consumer confidence. Many households are also delaying their Christmas spending in the hope that they can grab a bargain in the upcoming Black Friday sales. The cost of living squeeze meant more was spent on lower price indulgences. Helen Dickinson said retailers were cutting prices and streamlining operations as they sought to produce an affordable Christmas for their customers, but this was being jeopardised by a £470 million a year rise in business rates facing retailers next year. She called on Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, to freeze rates in this month's autumn statement to prevent extra cost pressure from pushing up prices. Paul Martin, the UK head of retail at KPMG, said, while consumers are now operating in a lower inflationary environment compared to October of last year, where inflation peaked at over 11%, there is no doubt that the last 12 months have taken a toll on confidence and their ability to spend. Coupled with a higher interest rate environment, dwindling COVID savings and the heating coming back on, beleaguered consumers are thinking very carefully about how they spend their money. As a result, the strong demand that has kept some retailers afloat over the last 18 months is now falling away. The Bank of England said recently it expected the economy to flatline in the second half of 2023. Threadneedle Street has penciled in zero growth rate for the third quarter and 0.1% expansion in the final 3 months of the year. Official figures for the July to September period will be released in the coming days. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. An influential group of economists said the United Kingdom's economy is in a horrible fiscal bind as it heads for recession with no room to cut taxes or increase public spending to offer a boost. The Institute for Fiscal Studies warned that Britain will slump into a moderate recession in the first half of 2024 as the struggle for growth remains while borrowing costs stay elevated. It comes as the Bank of England's chief economist warned that there was still work to do to bring Britain's inflation back under control, a hint that the base interest rate could rise yet again. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said there was little room for the tax cuts wanted by Tory MPs anytime soon in its green budget assessment of the nation's public finances ahead of Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's autumn statement. Using analysis by Citi, the Institute for Fiscal Studies report warned that the United Kingdom would fall into a recession at the start of 2024 that will last for 9 months. It also forecasts that gross domestic product GDP would slump by 0.7% next year. Paul Johnson, the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, said, "We are in a horrible fiscal bind. The price of our high levels of indebtedness, failure to stimulate growth, and high borrowing costs is likely to be a protracted period of high taxes and tight spending." The Institute for Fiscal Studies said there was no room for tax cuts or spending hikes, despite a six-year freeze on income tax thresholds would mean an extra £52 billion a year by 2027, the equivalent of raising the basic and higher rate of income tax by 6 pence. Paul Johnson said the amount raised by the fiscal drag process pushes people into higher income tax brackets as pay increases, and this was extraordinary. The Labour Party said the so-called stealth tax rise showed by the Tories had crashed the economy. Darren Jones, the shadow chief treasury secretary, said successive failures by Conservative ministers have left us with low economic growth, high taxes and national debt at the highest level in generations. The British newspaper The Express has also covered the same story. According to new research, around 3.2 million adults in the United Kingdom have missed some type of major bill payment in the last 2 years. The mortgage lender has found 6% of the adult population in the United Kingdom have missed either a mortgage payment, a debt repayment, rent, or energy bill. This comes amid the cost of living crisis, which has resulted in interest rates and energy bills skyrocketing. As a consequence of this, 4 in 10 adults have admitted to having missed multiple payments. Young adults are more likely to have experienced financial difficulty throughout the pandemic as the age group most affected by job instability. Some 11% of the 18 to 34-year-olds missed at least one usual payment in the past 2 years. This is nearly 4 times the amount of over 55s, and 6% of young adults have shared having missed multiple payments. Missing multiple payments could have a serious adverse effect on someone's credit score, which may prevent them from getting a mortgage or loan in the future. Based on the mortgage lender's research, here is a breakdown of the various payments people are failing to pay. 40% miss the utility bill payment, 27% miss paying their council tax, 25% missed their rent payments, and 23% missed personal loan repayments, and 7% missed their mortgage repayments. Peter Beaumont, the chief executive officer of the mortgage lender, broke down why mortgages and other repayments are hard for people to pay off at this moment in time. He explained, "The past 2 years have impacted many people's jobs and salaries, putting a squeeze on household finances. And with the rising cost of living, there is even greater pressure on the nation's finances. This can all lead an individual to miss a regular payment, which then could have a knock-on effect on their access to credit down the line."
Yeah. If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Majad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws regarding marriage based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javed. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. How are you? And welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Let's have this question first and foremost at the beginning of this episode regarding marriage. You know, can a girl, Sheikh Javed, marry someone without her father's permission?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Permission is a must, and a girl who is virgin and who is dependent on her father in making decisions, of course, should seek her father's permission.
Right.
And now there's a question which comes along, and that is, what does it mean to be dependent? Of course, to be independent or dependent. Okay. Yes. An independent girl is a girl whose father does not have any say in her decisions. For example, she has her own income. She lives separately from her father. Her father does not interfere in her matters. Whatever decisions she makes it by herself, and her father does not and make any decisions on her behalf. This is what independent means. If a girl is not independent, if she is virgin, she must obtain her father's permission. Otherwise, her marriage is not valid.
I see. Well, when and in what condition, Sheikh Javid, doesn't a girl actually need her father's permission?
Well, there are certain situations in which a girl does not need her father's permission. You know, her father's or paternal grandfather's permission, okay? Because the paternal grandfather is also a guardian, because he is the father of her father, and the father of the father is also a guardian. Now, in certain situations, as I said, a girl does not need, and it is not necessary for a woman to seek the permission of her father before getting married. One is if she's not virgin, of course. For example, she is married in the past, and she is a divorced woman, for example. She is no longer considered to be virgin. So in this case, she does not need her father's permission. Now, if she is a virgin, but her father or paternal grandfather refused to grant permission to her for marrying men, a man who is compatible in her eyes or in the eyes of Sharia, as well as in the eyes of custom. Now, you know, the father is grudging with his daughter, and he refuses to give permission. The girl is actually aging. She is now above 30, maybe she's 35 years old, and the father still refuses to give permission. In this case, if she knows that her father is not opposed to a particular person, and she will not allow her to marry even if that person, another person, is compatible and suitable in the eye of custom, in the eye of religion, in this case, she does not need her father's permission. She can go ahead getting married to the person who is compatible. Now, there is a third scenario in which the father does not, the father's permission is not required. If the father and the grandfather are not in any way willing to participate in the marriage, okay, the father or the grandfather says, okay, I have nothing to do with your marriage. Whether you want to marry or not, it's none of my business, okay? He says like this, the father says. So in this case, the girl can decide for herself to get married. Number four, if they are not in a capacity to give their consent, like, for example, in the case of mental illness, the father is insane, the father is incapacitated, the father is mentally retarded. Now, if he is retarded, he does not have the capacity to give permission. So his permission is not required because the father is incapacitated in that case. Now, there is a fifth scenario in which the father's permission is not required. If it's not possible to obtain his permission because of his absence or because of some other reasons, for example, the father is missing, the father is probably in jail, he cannot be contacted, he cannot be reached, okay?
So or the father is a drunkard.
A father is drunkard, very good.
Or the father or the mother, in fact, the whole family are, or they come from another religion.
You're right.
The girl is a Muslim, so
yes,
basically
you're
she
right,
doesn't
you're
need
right. The girl is Muslim, the father is non-Muslim. The father, a non-Muslim father does not have guardianship, wilaya, on their daughters.
Yes.
So the daughter can actually get married without her father's permission.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program. Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio.
Mm-hmm. The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program. And Shachar, with our guest speaker, we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws regarding marriage based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Shachar, if a girl's father or a paternal grandfather are no longer alive, all right?
Yes.
Does she still, the girl to be married, does she require her mother's permission or her brother's permission, for example, for marriage?
That's a good question. You know, many families, we see the brother and the mother, they exercise their authority in such a way as if they are the person who should be consulted in every matter, and they are the ones who think they should have the right to decide on other persons, on other people's behalf. That's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
When the father dies or when the paternal grandfather is no longer alive, then it is not necessary for the girl to obtain her mother's permission. The mother needs to be respected,
right,
and treated with dignity. The brother, okay, he is a brother, but he is not a guardian. So mm-hmm. in this case, he, of course, the girl does not need her mother's permission, nor does she need her brother's permission, because they are not her guardians.
I see. And one last question I may squeeze in here at the end. Is it permissible for a Muslim man or woman to marry a Christian or a person from other religions?
That's also a very good question, because it's one of the most frequently asked questions. Of course, a Muslim man, if he is not already married to a Muslim woman, is allowed to contract temporary marriage to a Christian woman. Temporary marriage is allowed.
Mm-hmm.
But permanent marriage is not permissible as an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about a Muslim woman? Can she marry a non-Muslim man, like a Christian or a Jewish man? Of course, it's not permissible for a Muslim woman to marry a non-Muslim man under any circumstances. It does not make any difference whether that man is a Christian or a Jew or a non-Kitabi man, like, for example, a Buddhist or a Sikh. So marriage is invalid in the later case.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Shavit. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Until we meet again, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير
of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz, for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.